Be seated, please. Next case of the morning is number 22-20028, Spiller versus Harris County. We'll hear first from Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This civil rights case stems from the decisions and actions of Mr. Lindsay. When he encountered Mr. Spiller and his girlfriend at the scene of a car accident, he was already having a bad day, and that he may have felt slighted by Mr. Spiller's preference for the other deputies on the scene. So he decided to take that out violently on Mr. Spiller by choking him and slamming him onto the hood of a car with no warning, no attempt to arrest Mr. Spiller, and no crime being committed. Based on the clearly established case law, the Fourth Amendment cannot tolerate these actions, nor can the First. As a result, the appellant has three main points on appeal. First, a jury could easily find that the force used was both objectively unreasonable and excessive, in part because there was no crime, no arrest attempt, and no provocation by Mr. Spiller, and in part due to the sheer speed of escalation, among other reasons. Second, a jury could just as easily find that there was no probable cause for to justify Mr. Spiller's arrest for interference, because there is no crime when the interference consists of speech only. So the arrest for Mr. Spiller's speech violates both the First and Fourth Amendments in that case. And third, the county defendants were prematurely dismissed despite a strong retaliation claim. The allegation of relevant examples that could belie the existence of both the policy and the custom, and the constable's policies based on her actions. Turning to my first point with respect to excessive force, a look at the district court's opinion itself, with all due respect to Judge Hughes, highlights exactly why this case should not have been dismissed on summary judgment. On RA 315, the district court says, quote, "The altercation escalated. Spiller spoke over Lindsay as Lindsay walked toward him. Lindsay grabbed him by the throat and slammed him down on the hood of the nearest car," unquote. He then follows that up on ROA 317, where he says, quote, "It is undisputed that Lindsay put his hand on Spiller's throat. A reasonable officer could see that reaction was lawful to respond to an uncooperative witness," unquote. That those propositions were not cited by the district court, and stand in direct contradiction to this court's case law. We can look at cases such as Goodson versus City of Corpus Christi, 202 F3rd 730, and Newman versus Goydrich, 703 F3rd 757, both of which are cases where we have plaintiffs that take some sort of action that the officer claims to have construed as a form of resistance or a form of action against the officer, immediately respond to force, and that force was held to be excessive and not be entitled to qualify.
Did Mr. Spiller suffer any injuries from being placed on the hood of the car?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, between being choked and being slammed on the hood of the car and the altercation
itself.
Then he got
taken to the ground because he was punching and kicking everybody in sight. So I said, did he sustain injury from being placed on the hood of the car?
It's difficult to pinpoint exactly which injuries came from which actions over the course of the entire altercation. However, the force of the choke and the force of the slam on the hood, in addition to the placement of where those pain points have persisted into the future, could definitely show that those injuries resulted from the force that he suffered immediately by the choking and the slamming.
I understand that one can use hyperbole in describing a situation. I did watch all of the body cam, which was some by Lindsay and some by the other officer, twice each. And I didn't perceive that what Lindsay did to the fellow was particularly severe.
Your Honor, I similarly watched the video multiple times.
I'm sure you have, because you filed the suit. And
absolutely, and at multiple speeds and all this. The force it takes to grab somebody by the throat and by the throat slam them onto a car is undoubtedly at least, you know, a medium degree of force in terms of the police sense, where you've got the highest levels of force, lethal force, the lowest levels of course, open hand control, or, you know, non-force events such as verbal commands and the like. So this is somewhere in the middle of all that, certainly. And the problem is, there's a number of problems. First of all, the speed of the escalation. Between Joseph versus Bartlett, this court's case, and the Graham factors, we can look at a number of things. Again, the speed of the escalation, we can look at the severity of the crime. The only crime that could arguably have precipitated the use of force in this case was the interference of police duties by speech only. The only thing that happened between Mr. Spiller and Mr. Lindsay before the use of force were they were talking to each other. Of course, the voices were raised, tensions escalated, largely in part due to Mr. Lindsay.
But you do concede that Spiller's elbow made contact with Officer Lindsay's abdomen. There's no dispute about that, right? This was before being grabbed by the neck and slammed down into the car. There was this, now you call it unintentional, correct? Inadvertent, unintentional?
That's correct.
But does that intent matter? Does Spiller's intent matter? I mean, could a reasonable officer view the elbow making contact with his abdomen as an act of aggression?
Your Honor, I believe the intent and specifically the way that the video plays out in this case, you know, where you see these two kind of closing on each other. I mean, Mr. Spiller is largely stationary. Mr. Lindsay comes toward him and then he kind of tries to edge around. It's a lot like, again, the Goodson and the Newman cases. In both of those cases, one of them, the plaintiff jerked their arm away from the handcuffs as the officers were attempting to arrest him. And the other one, the plaintiff backed into the officer. This is exactly that same level of, this is contact that happens when people are close together. Whether or not Mr. Lindsay perceived some sort of aggression, this court has stated that that level of contact is not entitled to the qualified immunity defense when it comes to immediately escalating the force as a result of that contact alone. And in addition to the fact that the interference with speech only was the only arguable crime that Mr. Spiller could have been arrested for, we also have to look at the fact that he posed no perceivable safety threat to Mr. Lindsay or anybody else on the scene. There were three officers that were all, they all had body armor, they were all armed. Mr. Spiller was not. He exhibited a calm demeanor until Mr. Lindsay walked up. And in addition, we can look at the relationship between the need for force and the amount used. Again, there's nothing that happened leading up to the use of force that indicated to Mr. Spiller that he was about to be placed under arrest. There was nothing that indicated that he needed to do something different than what he was doing in terms of he was just trying to ask a question. All he was trying to do was get a question and then proceed with whatever the officer needed him to do. So none of that under the excessive force factors should justify any use of force at all.
Well, if he can't point to specific injury, not even a bruise, should the Fourth Amendment deal in trivialities?
The Fourth Amendment, the limitation on the Fourth Amendment is, of course, there is no recognition of de minimis injuries. However, in this case, we do have injuries. In terms of sussing them out between which specific instances of force over the course of a dynamic encounter, that is a question that should squarely fall on a fact finder to determine, okay, what are the long-term injuries, what's compensable, at what point does the force turn from excessive and unreasonable to justified and reasonable? Because at a certain point, of course, we didn't sue the other officer for using a taser, because at that point, the taser was justified, we would not have had a claim for that. So determining what that point is, what injuries occurred before and which are compensable, are the exact kind of questions that should be left for a fact finder, making this case inappropriate for summary judgment. Turning then to probable cause for interference, again, Texas Penal Code section 38.15 subsection D says that there is no crime for interference for speech only. And this court and the Texas state courts have read that statute in the exact same way. Now, with respect to a subsequent probable cause finding, the only reference in the record to that subsequent probable cause finding was a reference to Harris County Public Records, but there was no actual documentation included, no support of that documentation attached, and no consideration for the exceptions to those subsequent probable cause findings, including that under Miley versus Briggs, probable cause determined by an independent intermediary without any support, including for a crime that does not exist, interference for speech only, does not satisfy the probable cause amendment to justify an arrest, or alternatively, if there is a material misrepresentation. Now, as to the argument that Mr. Speller could have been arrested for DWI, this court's doctrine of the related offense doctrine, squarely prohibits exactly that kind of post hoc justification of why an arrest was made. The offense for DWI was not related to the claimed interference with police duties that Mr. Lindsay was claiming that Mr. Spiller should be arrested for. Because that level of intoxication, first of all, is not part of the equation when it comes to the interference, but also because we can look at things like the fact that Mr. Lindsay asked Mr. Spiller to get in his car and follow them to a secondary location. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't report that an officer that sincerely believes somebody should be arrested for DWI to then get back in that car and keep driving. So without any basis for probable cause, whether for interference or for DWI, the arrest itself can't be supported under the Fourth Amendment, and because it was in response to Mr. Spiller's speech to Mr. Lindsay and to the other deputies, neither the Fourth nor the First Amendment can, or both the Fourth and the First Amendment are violated by that action. And turning finally to the municipal defendants, that being Harris County and Constable Walker, the case was prematurely dismissed because appellant has a strong ratification claim. It was reviewed all the way to the constable herself. There was all the body cam videos that we have all seen, that we have all reviewed. And when it comes to ratification, first of all, review by a policymaker is a key part of that. So we have policymakers that reviewed the videos and determined that Officer Lindsay's actions were okay. This comports with our policy as the county. And this court, of course, there's the grand staff standard of sufficiently extreme conduct. And then there was also, as a follow-up to that, the Worldwide Creatures versus Columbia case, 541 F3rd 747, that was this court in 2009, which appellant reads to state that something that is clearly established by case law to be over a constitutional line can count as sufficiently extreme conduct. In addition to that, we see on the record pages 101 and 102, that's plaintiff's first amended complaint paragraphs 58 to 65, we've pled that the constable is a policymaker. We've pled that this specific officer, Mr. Lindsay, has a history of excessive force. We've pleaded at least two similar excessive force instances, and that there are other issues, or that there are other cases where claimants were discouraged from filing complaints against the county. And in addition to that, we see Constable Walker's actions in terms of hiring, in terms of discipline, that led to Mr. Lindsay being placed in exactly this position with the belief that he could use force in this way, and was then subsequently justified in using force in this way when he was not disciplined by the county. So for these reasons, we ask this court to reverse and remand the both district court's orders against all of the applicants. Thank you.
All right, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. We'll hear first from Mr. Hall.
Morning, may it please the court. My name is Michael Hall. I represent Deputy Jared Lindsay, and Lindsay only in this case. I kind of thought this was a relatively routine case when I first got it. I do believe there was a probable cause. As far as the interference with public duties, there's plenty of cases that point that are very similar. Take, for example, out of the Fifth Circuit, Haggerty versus TSU. I talk about it in the brief, but that was a case where a teacher is interfering with an officer trying to arrest a student at Texas Southern University, and the officer tells him to move away. And he does it first, and then the officer takes the suspect into a building, and the teacher comes back, and he gets within about 10 to 15 feet, and he starts talking loudly or yelling at the officer and leaving the kid alone. He gets arrested. But the thing was, is the more important parts of that is an officer could be wrong about probable cause and still have qualified immunity. We don't have to determine whether it was, what a state court would have done had they charged him with 38.15. It's just a fair probability. Was there a fair probability? That's what we talk about in Haggerty versus TSU. And then you have another similar case that just came out of the U.S. Supreme Court a few years ago, and I can't pronounce the name, Nieves versus Bartlett. Again, similar case. Police officer was talking to some kids, underage drinkers presumably, and somebody is yelling at him, "Don't talk to the cops, don't talk to the cops." The police officer starts to approach this guy, he runs away. A little bit later, same thing's happening to another police officer, and instead the guy now inserts himself between the police officer and the kids and is yelling at the police officer, "Leave the kids alone." And then gets up in the police officer's face. He never touches him, but the police officer pushes him back. The other police officer
here, under Texas law, what was the crime exactly? At the moment where Officer Lindsay grabs Spiller by the neck, slams him under the car, what was the crime?
The most obvious one, Your Honor, was assault.
Because of the elbow?
Yeah, he hit him.
He hit him?
Well, he struck him.
Is there a difference between elbowing somebody and having their elbow make contact with somebody?
But you can see him move his arm up like this in the video. So I don't want to split those hairs because he did it intentionally. He did this. And you can hear the thwack. On one video, you can hear the thwack. On Lane's video, you can actually see it. And then on Lindsay's video, you can hear it. So, looking at them both together, he did it. That's an assault. Assault under Texas law is intentionally or knowingly causing physical contact with another when the person knows or should reasonably believe that the other will regard the contact as offensive or provocative. And that's exactly what it was. And bear in mind, before this point, there's already noticed that he's going to be difficult. He's been told several times to quit answering for the girlfriend. Three times he's told, and the thing is, he can go with the girlfriend. He's told three times, she's going with Officer Lane, Deputy Lane. You can follow. That's not a problem. We want to get off the highway. Nobody wanted to get hit, and that's all it was about, and that wasn't good enough for him. And he decides he wants to talk to somebody else. That's just not the way it works. This is a crime scene investigation. It's not a place for debate. So, I believe he was interfering. It's very similar to the Nieves case versus Bartlett. And there is a defense in 38.15, and it says words only. It doesn't say words, it says words only. And these cases I cited in the brief, there was no contact, there was no threats. it was just that kind of interference with the duties. I mean, where you actually are stopping the officer from doing what he's supposed to do. And as the court said, I believe it was in Hagney, you know, there's a time and place for this, and that's not it when the officer is trying to arrest somebody or conduct a Terry stop or whatever it was he was doing at the time.
There seems to be, I'm back to the elbow again, a dispute over whether Speller elbowed Lindsay, as you contend, or whether he maneuvered around him with his elbow.
I think, Your Honor, they're both moving towards each other. Mm-hmm. And I think when they got too close, Speller just gives him the elbow. He wasn't moving north or south. They were moving east-west into each other. And I don't know. And the more important thing, Your Honor, is it's what a reasonable officer would perceive. And in the video, you also see other officers walk up to Lindsay and say, "I saw it, he hit you." You see the tow truck driver walk up and say, "I saw it, he hit me." So that's what he perceived, and he may have been wrong, but that's, you know, he can still have qualified immunity if he's wrong. It was reasonable. And again, you have about a minute where it's ratcheting up there, where he's giving directions, he's telling him to do something. They're very simple directions. He can stay with his girlfriend, and he's not happy about that. And in the end, we find out afterwards, which doesn't affect your analysis, but they've both been drinking. And I'm sure he just wanted to get out of there. And Lindsay, right from the start, could smell it. He asked Lane, "Do you smell it?" "I smell it everywhere." Booze. So there were suspicions. Now, he primarily thought the girlfriend was drunk. He didn't know about Spiller, because the girlfriend just drove the car into the wall, one car accident. But the thing about Hagerty is they talked about, as people kind of close in, the officer has to do something. It's kind of that situation. And as they get closer and closer, he's got to do something. Nothing in the Constitution requires an officer to take a hit or wait till somebody. So once he touched him, a provocative touch, he assaulted him. He gets arrested. At least it's a fair reading. You know, a reasonable officer will believe there's probable cause for that he committed a crime or was trying to commit a crime.
I think I'm just trying to square the reasonable officer standard that you articulate with the summary judgment standard of genuine factual disputes surviving summary judgment.
Well, you do a pretty good explanation in the Joseph case, Your Honor. It flips the burden. When there's qualified immunity, it flips the burden. I mean, it's up to them to show there's a case. Well, it's up to them in the first instance to show that it was a violation. And in the second instance, to show that it's objectively unreasonable, to go back in time and to look at what was available and what the officer should have known.
You don't usually have a third party on the scene saying to the officer, "He hit you." There's a fact issue maybe when you don't have a third party witness, but
we have four or five witnesses that saw that. So between the two of you, there's proper cause. Even if he's mistaken, it's reasonable. You don't seem convinced.
I'm not sure there's much more to say unless one of the judges has questions, because video's the video.
You're right, Your Honor. It's about 20 seconds. The whole thing boils down to about 20 seconds. Actually, about a minute where the questioning starts. But that's it. So we'd ask the court to affirm the dismissal. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, sir. Thank you. Ms. Bradley?
Yes. Good morning. My name is Suzanne Bradley, and I represent Harris County and Constable Mae Walker in this case. And as a threshold matter, dovetailing off what my co-counsel just said, if this court finds that Officer Lindsay has qualified immunity. Harris County and Constable Walker are out. So that's easy. But this case comes to the court on a motion to dismiss for Harris County and Constable May Walker. And while the standard is de novo, and that we must accept all of Mr. Spiller's allegations as true, as a matter of law, Mr. Spiller fails to show what I understand counsel to focus on is the policy and custom of the precinct. First of all, I have two issues before this court. One is ratification, and the second is whether or not plaintiff's complaint or appellant's complaints can survive on Monell at the motion to dismiss stage. First of all, on ratification, there is no clear cause of action as to ratification for Constable Walker on her individual basis. Now, for me, this was a little muddy, and so I sent the case to the court recently, the Hobart case, at 916 Fed Sub 799. Now, this is not a precedential case for this court, but it is very instructive. And in there, the district court goes through the analysis and talks about how ratification is really as to a municipality, not as to an individual. And I would like to take it just a little bit further, Your Honor. I think what this appellate wants this court to do is take ratification and turn it into respondeat superior one for Harris County and for Constable May Walker. And you just can't do that. The Supreme Court case law is clear that you cannot tag a county, tag a municipality on the basis of respondeat superior one. Further, the case law in this court is clear that the supervision, official supervision, an official can only be held officially liable if he participates in the acts that cause the constitutional injury or if she implements unconstitutional policies. Now, there's no evidence, and at the motion to dismiss stage, we didn't get to that point, but there's no evidence on the video that Constable May Walker was out there that night participating in the acts that Mr. Spiller alleges. And I would take it further, plaintiff's petition, which is a First Amendment petition, and it begins at, the record site is 95 through 110. Plaintiff's petition is very thin on what unconstitutional policies Constable Walker allegedly implemented. Here the appellant says that the Constable Walker knew Sergeant Lindsay was fired from a prior job for excessive force, that there was a complaint of racism against him, and that she watched the video and did not discipline Sergeant Lindsay. Well, first of all, Harris County and the precinct don't have a policy of excessive force, and there is no respondeat superior. And the two cases the plaintiff cites as examples under Monell, at record 102, one is an August 2019 case where a constable Nolan broke an arm of a female and then falsely charged her with interference of public duties. And then the next example is a May 4, 2020 Precinct 7 deputy who tasered a shackled and handcuffed an African-American suspect. And despite the review of the incident by the precinct, this person was not disciplined, and plaintiffs alleged that he was promoted. Well, this simply is not ratification. Ratification, the landmark case there, of course, is Grandstaff. And the facts of Grandstaff, of course, are extraordinary. An individual is driving down the road in a car too slow. Deputies and the sheriff of that small county were speeding after someone who supposedly was causing a traffic issue. And they found this random guy on the road and they filled his car and his body with bullets. In that particular case, this court said, okay, we're going to go ahead and allow you to get to the county. But the Frere case talks about, from this court, which is at 957 F. 2nd at 1278, that the refusal to punish a deputy is not ratification. And frankly, the cases, or the facts that I've heard them here in this court, as they have alleged, are just not the extreme type of facts that we see in Grantstown. I would also refer the case to the court to Peterson at 588 Fed 3rd 848. And then finally, the Coon v. Ledbetter case has foreclosed that even if this behavior was found to be illegal later, it cannot be assumed that it resulted from official policy. And the Peterson case also emphasizes this. So the facts that appellant wants this court to rely on in terms of Constable Walker just don't get to the extreme nature of Grantstown. And you can't assume just because she looked at the video that she ratified the conduct, even if somebody later found out that this decided that this was illegal. This court can't assume that it was because of official policy. Now, it's also important to note here that Harris County did not train or supervise Sergeant Lindsay. He's a precinct employee. He's hired by the precinct and trained by the precinct. And this dovetails into my argument.
Since when is that legally meaningful?
Since
I never heard constables being divorced for liability purposes from Harris County.
Your Honor, I would refer you to the Coates case, which is a state case, and I'd also refer you to all the cases cited in my brief that talk about how a precinct constable is not a policymaker for a county. That's long-time law from the Fifth Circuit.
Well, I know he's elected separately, but if they're... But Lindsay was an officer, wasn't he an officer of the constable's office?
Lindsay was.
But can the constable's office be sued?
The constable's office is non-sui juris, Your Honor.
Well, so that you can't sue the DA, right?
Not the district attorney, Your Honor, no. In this case, it would be the county. But this court has long held that constables are not policymakers for the county. And if you don't have a policymaker, that's the first prong of Monell, and you're out. But even if this court wanted to decide that Constable Walker was a policymaker, they have not shown a policy, and they have not shown that policy is a driving force for Mr. Spiller's injury. And just so I can back up a little bit, I wanted to point out that one of the things appellant argues is that they should have been allowed some discovery. Well, under this court's Carswell case, and under both Ashcroft and Twombly, the Supreme Court says that when qualified immunity is asserted, discovery can be stayed and stopped. And when they just cite two examples in their First Amendment petition, and one of them is post-event, they've really only cited one, and one of them is a tasing incident. And Mr. Lindsay didn't tase Mr. Spiller.
Okay, well, I think we have your argument. You're down to zero time.
Oh, I am. It goes by fast.
Yes, you can.
Your Honor, I would just urge the court to affirm the dismissal of Harris County and Constable May Walker. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Sorry.
That's okay. May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. I will get through as many points on appeal or on rebuttal as I can get through. I will go in reverse order, so I'll start with three or four points against the county. First is that my colleague on the other side said at the beginning that if Mr. Lindsay is dismissed because of qualified immunity, then that would get rid of the case against the county. I just want to nitpick that just a little bit, because qualified immunity, of course, is a two-step process where you first look at whether or not there was a violation and then whether or not the violation was clearly established. If there was a violation, the county does not have the same protection about the clear establishment. If we can show that there was a violation that's attributable to county policy or was otherwise ratified, that clear establishment does not excuse the county in the same way that it excuses the officer. So that's my first point. My second about ratification, just to clarify, the ratification claim is just against the county. We do allege that Constable Walker did review the video, and that's necessary to the claim against the county, but it is not a distinct claim against Constable Walker individually. So just to clarify that point. We also sat at Bogart and discussed it fairly extensively in our brief. So our points on that, to the extent that they diverge from what you've heard here, we'll leave for the briefing. As for the point about our argument devolving into respondeat superior, with all due respect, that's simply not true. What we're saying is that ratification requires some level of escalation and review by a policymaker. And in this case, we're saying that policymaker, with respect to discipline, hiring, firing, all of that, is Constable Walker. She reviewed the video, had a chance to do something about it, and chose not to. That is far removed from simple respondeat superior. You know, your employee did something wrong, therefore you're liable. There's, in my mind, a gulf between those
two. Well, what do you say to their argument that the constable is not a policymaker?
With all due respect, I do disagree with that quite fairly vehemently. We briefed this on page 21 of our principal brief. There's a note, footnote 88, cites several cases where precincts, constables have been found to be policymakers, and we allege specifically that she is the policymaker with respect to some of the issues that we're looking at here, hiring, firing, discipline, training of the deputies in her precinct. And just to finish up ratification real quick, the problem that it's trying to avoid is the, we investigated ourselves and found we did nothing wrong problem. We want to disincentivize municipal entities from being able to do that. I'll just note before moving on to the case against Officer Lindsay, there was kind of a paradox presented about, these policies aren't attributable to the county, but then the precinct isn't suable. We specifically did not name the precinct in our lawsuit for that exact reason. We know that we can't bring an action against them. So there is a point at which it's a county entity that has to be attributable to the county at some point. And to the extent that we can show that Constable Walker is the policymaker, that's where we can get Harris County in the case. With respect to Hill, again, a number of things that I know I only have so much time left, so I'll just speak through as much as I can and stop when the red light comes on. But first, with respect to assault, he was not arrested for assault, he was arrested for interference. So to the extent that we can look back after the fact now with all these videos and everything else and say, oh, well, Mr. Lindsay was assaulted.
Well, he split his lip. Okay, so the fact that they didn't charge him with assault is really, factually, it makes no sense, but they can always decide one incident may embody more than one violation.
That is, of course, true, Your Honor. However, that could not have happened before the initial takedown. The lip was not split until after the initial takedown.
Well, then, that whole encounter maybe at 5 seconds. It's really fast once it starts.
Right, but the point being the assault did not occur before.
Yeah,
that,
but
sorry.
An unwanted touching, as Judge Willett pointed out, is an assault technically.
In certain instances it could be, if I may answer your question and briefly conclude. But in this case, again, there's factual argument of fact finder could just as well see my side of things that he was just trying to get around and talk to the other deputy because they were catty-cornered to each other. And to the extent that there's people saying, they saw Officer Lindsay being hit, to my knowledge, to my understanding of the way those conversations went, that was in reference to after the takedown, after that it already started. I did not understand that to be in reference to the elbowing specifically.
Mr. Hull says that Officer Lindsay's entitled to be wrong, that if he perceived it or misperceived it at the time as an intentional or aggressive act, he's entitled to be mistaken about that. What do you say?
Again, with all due respect, I think that that's flat wrong for a couple of reasons. The first is the cases that I've kind of kept coming back to in oral argument, Newman and Goodson, both, in both of those cases, the officers interpreted the plaintiff's actions differently than the review advocate found them to be. So there's a certain level of parallel there that we can use for qualified immunity, and also to show that that just an officer perceiving any slight for any reason can be used to justify force. I just don't think it's the case. And secondly, with respect to that, there is further probable cause case law from the Supreme Court that, you know, it wasn't a major issue between the parties, so it wasn't briefed in depth. With respect to that point, so if more briefing is required, we'd be happy to submit supplemental letter brief. But there is case law from with respect to probable cause determinations can't necessarily be a lower standard on the street than they are before a magistrate, and vice versa. Just because, you know, that there's a certain point at which a line has to be drawn whether there is probable cause or there isn't.
Do you have any expert testimony?
Not yet, Your Honor, because discovery was not concluded by the time the motions were filed. We would have expert testimony in the event that we were allowed to continue discovery.
Did you move to keep discovery open?
We believed at the time when we responded that there was enough evidence, there was a lack of evidence on their side to have met their burden and enough evidence for the video to make our case.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, thank you. We have your argument. And sorry, Mike. We will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.